Good. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, where we talk about politics, social issues, and current events. My name is Jazza. Jimmy's name is Jimmy.
Yep.
Do you want to say some more so people know what your voice sounds like?
I feel if they don't know now, it's probably too late for them, really.
It's too late for them. And we have a guest this week in the form of Miles Dyer, also known as Blade376. Say hello, Miles.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going really well. Oh, God, you've got your radio voice on now. We would listeners, we were just chatting, and he was about two semitones higher than his voice is right now.
I don't know. Maybe I'll step into it, but I don't know.
It's okay. We'll get you nice and relaxed. It's fine. So this week, we're going to be chatting about, as always, three topics that have been happening in the week of current events. We'll be chatting specifically about the decision by the UK Parliament to partake in airstrikes on IS in Syria. Although we're meant to be calling them Daesh now. Everybody calls them Daesh.
I mean, all the politicians do, but all the, you know, actual real human beings call them IS or ISIS.
I did notice that they, quite a lot of them, when they were debating, were struggling with the whole Daesh pronunciation.
Yeah, so there are a couple of variations. Right,
they'd only seen it written down, and so lots of people were calling them Daesh.
Daesh, yeah. Daesh, Dash, Daesh.
Well, I know Barack Obama calls them Dash, so...
Yeah, I know, but Barack Obama's Barack Obama. He can do whatever the hell he wants.
He can.
And then that's going to lead quite smoothly, we think, or at least we're going to make it seem like it's smooth. No, we won't. This is the Right Dishonourable. We will talk about the French regional elections that are taking place today, which is the 6th of December, and next Sunday as well. They're going to be electing the leaders of the regions, aren't they, Jimmy? That's right.
That is right, yeah.
And the National Front, or Le Front National, seem to be surging, especially in the wake of the Paris attacks. And Marion Le Pen, who is 26 and really right-wing, is quite fit as well.
We're not supposed to be judging politicians purely on their physical merits,
Jazza. I know, Jimmy.
This isn't the Labour leadership election.
I mean, but I'm allowed to say that because I'm ironically saying it, because obviously, as a gay man, she doesn't really tickle my pickle. Anyway, and then finally, because of suggestions that we had on Twitter, we're going to be talking about Sam Pepper and his most recent foray into viral video making. Miles, can I get you to make a just general sound that you feel when you... hear the name Sam Pepper? I think that's pretty accurate. Shall we listen to some music and then start talking about Syria?
Yay. This week in the Commons, MPs voted to extend the bombing campaign from Iraq into Syria to cover more of the land that ISIS is currently in control of. Miles, you seemed, judging by Twitter, not to be too happy with what was going on. Maybe you could explain more about the situation and why you object to what's just happened.
Yeah, sure. So I think firstly, much of the debate in the Commons and actually across the general public was done with a false dichotomy, which is either we bomb Daesh in Syria or we do nothing. And I think that isn't the case. For many people, they were looking at what the motion was that was being passed, which was very wishy-washy. It's very open-ended language. And there were lots of different elements of the bill which didn't have much detail. So there was a lot of discussion about how if we were bombing, there would be around 70,000 ground troops that we'd be able to support, which was made up of lots of different factions. There was talks that we're already doing airstrikes in Iraq, and Daesh keep going back to the Syria border where we're not bombing currently and regrouping. But we have to remember that for over a year now, the US has been bombing in Syria. They've done over 8,000 bombing campaigns. France has obviously been involved as well. And so I always just ask the question of, you know, so what has been happening in Syria? Has there been like an area of land that they've sort of left open with like a reserved for Britain card on it, you know, saying we're not going to be bombing that until Britain get into it. The way I see it, and it's that with no disrespect for the things that happened after the Paris attacks, but this is clearly political posturing, because when I remember that David Cameron went to the House of Commons to try and get a vote on airstrikes in Syria not too long ago, and then he took it off the table because it was clearly not going to go through. And then I remembered that was on November the 3rd, I believe, last month. And so the only thing that has really changed since then is the attacks on Paris. The UK government says that we've had 7 potential terrorist attacks on British soil that we've managed to avert. But those haven't happened just since Paris. Like, we've been very much aware of it. And other arguments that have been made is if the UK did get attacked and we looked out to our allies for support, we'd expect them to help us. But my point is, if we did get attacked, bombing Syria would still not be the answer, even though it would seem like the right emotive thing to do. And I mean, there are lots of things we can discuss about Syria and that. But the main concerns I have is Daesh have moved into a heavily populated area called the city of Raqqa, which is a population of around 150,000 people. A very small percentage are of Daesh. And actually, the motion that's been put forward isn't clear. And actually, one of the most important things you should have when proposing a military strategy is having an exit strategy, because otherwise you fall into something that is called mission creep, which is the notion that you stray away from your original objectives, which is exactly what happened in Libya in 2011, where we originally went in to impose a no-fly zone. And then later on, actually, 4 days later, it became an issue of regime change. And look what happened to Libya. We completely ditched it.
Is your view that nobody should be bombing Syria, not the Americans and not the French?
Correct. Or if there is a bombing, that it's done with there isn't an absolute cohesive strategy put forward. So someone said to me the other day, within the first 2 days of the bombing, they've been bombing oil fields that are owned by Daesh to cut off their revenue. And they're saying, so is that justified? And a part of me says, well, it is justified. But if that was what the motion was to the House of Commons, that we want to bomb these oil fields, I would be more inclined to say, yeah, let's do it. But then at the same time, I would say, well, why hasn't America done it? And actually,
I do kind of understand that desire for there to be more specific things that the MPs are voting on, right? Yeah. But also, I kind of look at it from the other perspective. And if every time that the mission changes slightly, so from bombing a particular area or a particular city to bombing airfields to bombing something else, the government actually, by the way, never uses the word bombing. It's always airstrikes,
yeah.
Which I don't think necessarily sounds an awful lot better. But if we have to kind of take it to a vote again and again and again, that reduces the amount of agility that we have as somebody who is taking part in the region. Like, I do understand where you're coming from, but then also, like, in terms of practicality of the way that we're going to be carrying out military exercises, it wouldn't really work, no?
No, I agree with that. So there definitely has to be flexibility, but then I'd say there has to be a middle ground. So it's kind of, you don't want to be, so every time there is a new site to bomb that we go to the House of Commons, yeah, I agree, it'd be ridiculous to have votes on that. But at the same time, it is so open-ended. So during the debate, David Cameron was asked, if we then got to a point where we had to send in ground troops, would you come back to the House of Commons to have a vote on that? And David Cameron's response was, I would not like that to happen. So,
I mean, strictly speaking, the Prime Minister doesn't actually have to ask the Commons to invade a country at all. He's just allowed to do that, isn't he?
Absolutely. But this is a blank spot on my part, but I believe, isn't that only when it's a matter of war where we are fighting in self-defence? Because that's been the main premise.
The argument for self-defence can be used in so many different ways.
I don't believe there's actually it doesn't need to be about self-defence. It's just a power the Prime Minister has. I mean, he could theoretically, I think, invade France tomorrow, and he wouldn't have to go to the House.
I was about to say, why isn't the Kingdom of France now a thing? I'm very disappointed.
Yeah. Now, well, I mean, my thoughts are with this that this whole debate has been really interesting because it looks to the heart of the democratic process and in which decisions are made. So, a colleague of mine said the other day, a couple of weeks ago, that, you know, we could look at all the protests that have been happening against the bombing of Syria and going, well, look, you know, the protests against the Iraq War in 2003 and how that didn't really have an effect. So why would people be doing it now? But the difference is that obviously there's an increase in social media usage from the general public. But it's also the fact that in 2003, Tony Blair was an incredibly strong leader. He had a huge wealth of support behind him, although there were a lot of MPs that then went against the whip. So it was kind of seen as this moment where it was already going to be going forward. And actually, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that it was anyway with the conversations he was having with George Bush. We obviously have to wait for the Chilcot report to come out to confirm that. But this time around, we've got Jeremy Corbyn, who is against military intervention, and a shadow cabinet, half of which were for it. Obviously, Hillary Benn, the shadow foreign secretary. And therefore, with all these things combined, such as that of the use of social media and an opposition party that is divided so obviously in the lead up to a vote, there has never been a better opportunity to have scrutiny on the policy being proposed. And that sort of gives me a bit of hope in a way that, yes, the vote did go through, but there was actually some really good discussion around the merits of bombing. And actually, the conversation is still going on now. It hasn't sort of just gone dead. People are still talking about it.
That's been something that's been kind of really a positive in terms of the way that I've interpreted it, is that everybody's really engaged with it. This is the most engaged that I've seen the public on like an issue for a really long time. That may just because I have a very specific sphere of people that I follow on Twitter and that are in my Facebook feed and that I like talk to on a daily basis. But people seem way more interested in this than the usual, probably because there's so many echoes of like Iraq 10 years ago, and also like social justice warriors on the internet seem to be particularly strong at the moment. Miles, I wanted to ask, I don't feel like for after the video that you made, which is amazing, and if you haven't seen it, listeners, you should go to youtube.com/blade376. What you believe that there should be some kind of intervention, right? That we shouldn't just be letting Daesh get on with their thing in Syria, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But the main concern I have is you look at it's crazy that Daesh has a magazine that they release.
The Dead Tree Press is not dead yet.
yeah, of course.
I mean, given some of the obscure magazines that I've seen, it doesn't really surprise me too much.
Well, for me, it's a question of the propaganda rhetoric that, propaganda is a form of rhetoric. Don't need to put those two words together. But
it's okay. You love it. It's fine.
Daesh want it to seem like a West versus Middle East war. And so we've had, within the last couple of days, German MPs have voted for military action in Syria now. I know that with the elections coming up in Spain, there's already Don't Bomb Syria protests happening there. And I just feel like, you know, it's political posturing from our part to support our allies. But on the flip side, it's also political posturing over there in the sense of, oh, look, it's the West coming in again. Like Saudi Arabia, I hate to use these cliches, but regional powers who have these military forces need to play more of a role. And the fact that we are getting more and more entrenched in Syria is actually giving them more of a reason to take a back seat. Now, I know why Saudi Arabia, I could assume why Saudi Arabia really doesn't want to get involved. It's because it's got a lot of internal conflict within their own country, different factions. You know, they've been exporting Wahhabism across many regions, and actually there's a lot to point out that they are directly or indirectly funding Daesh. And we look at Turkey that's bombing the Kurds. And you can just look at this huge quagmire that's going on there. Like, we are literally going into a proxy war.
I don't understand, if you have those misgivings about Turkey and Saudi Arabia, why you'd want to leave it to them to sort the situation out.
It's not necessarily leave them. I'm not saying that when they get involved, they just do it on their own, but we should be putting pressure on them to shape their attitudes in the region. Because if it's a horrible thing to think about, but it's like, if it did get so bad that it started spilling to their borders, and actually there's arguments that Daesh are inside Saudi Arabia at the moment, there is going to get a point where they have to step in. But you're right, there could be an argument that we shouldn't be leaving it to them, but Turkey's a NATO.
Is it true that you do think there are some conditions in which you would support military intervention from the West?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's an unfortunate thing for Jeremy Corbyn when he gets asked about, like, you know, he gets given those hypotheticals and he will dismiss it as a hypothetical. And I totally understand he doesn't want to be misquoted, but at the same time, like, never say never. There's always going to be a point where it may be necessary, and it's a horrible situation. Anyone who is for or against the airstrikes cannot say with absolute moral certainty. But I think, just if you look, the vote in the House of Commons a few days ago was on a particular motion, and I urge anyone who's not read it yet to look at the motion. It is not specific. It is, and David Cameron, a couple of days after the vote, said, or even 24 hours later, said, "Oh yeah, this will probably go on for a year, 2 years." And it's just,
yeah. Going back to the involvement of, like, other regional powers in the Middle East. Correct me if I'm wrong, but there are. I feel like Jordan and Turkey have been partaking in airstrikes, but they only have a certain amount of capacity that they're able to take part, right? And so that's why you end up having the biggest military powers in the world, bar China, which are still the UK, France, and the USA. And isn't that kind of why we've been drawn into it, right? Because there's only so much that the local powers can do.
That is true. I heard someone say the other day, and I need to check this, that I think there's currently 12 different air forces operating in the skies of Syria. Like, do we really need another one in there?
Yeah, with Russia included as well, by the way, which is kind of just awkward, since they've already lost a jet to the Turks, which is just, yay, World War III.
And this is why I bring up proxy war. And again, to all the listeners who aren't aware of this, just to sort of, I say, clear up the mess. I'm actually going to explain how complicated it really is. You've got Turkey, a NATO ally that has been bombing Kurds who have been fighting Syria. You've got the Russians backing Assad, who have been bombing the Free Syrian Army and are bombing IS. We are supposedly going in there to support factions like the Free Syrian Army and others to take on IS. But some of them are getting bombed by Russia. So by an indirect route, i.e. a proxy war, we are actually at war with Russia in some ways. We're just going to be funding.
Oh, that's a stretch. That is a stretch.
Is it a stretch, though?
Yeah,
because
of course it is.
Look at. Well, then I'd say,
I don't really think it is a stretch, Jazza.
Well, so let me explain this. So the 70,000 they mention is made of 100 factions. About, I think, 24 are factions of one particular group. The name doesn't come to mind right now. But their primary concern is actually taking on Assad. And so let's say they do take on IS, Daesh. What happens after then? They will then take on Assad,
who is
our interest. And Assad has been defended by Russia. So all I'm saying is there is actually a conflict via proxy war that is, okay, it may not be happening now, but it will happen sooner rather than later. So we need that political solution. And there are agreements, like in Vienna, with Russia at the moment. I hope we make more progress with that. But if we're looking at military intervention alone, we are going to be clashing with Russia, which I find...
Yeah, but I've said this on the podcast before. I said it when Lewis was on a couple of weeks ago. I genuinely think that we need to be dealing with the best. It's simplifying it a huge amount, but better the W, no. I think we need to, for now, be supporting Assad and then moving to, like putting pressure on him afterwards to move to a different form of government where he isn't gassing his own people.
That seems like that will very likely be pulled off. I'm sure that will actually happen.
So apparently this is how the Russians are dealing with him. They're saying, we're going to support you in this, but there needs to be a transition of government afterwards. Oh. Obviously, like commitments to not using chemical weapons on his own people, for example. But I think that is the route that we should be going on. And I think that's bad judgment on the West's part for just supporting the rebels, because our primary function in that region at the moment should be, I think, to get rid of IS. And then if that means kind of having someone save you people on our team for the time being, I think that is a something that we would need to be doing. But also, not an MP, so don't get a vote, so it doesn't matter.
I'm with you completely on that. There was actually something I said in the video I made, but I cut out, and I think it's just because I always hate drawing these parallels, and I don't think it is suitable, but I'm happy to bring it up here, even though I sort of say that with complete caution of don't take this on face value, but maybe it's a thought that you two would explore. But people that feel very uncomfortable with the idea of siding with Assad against Daesh, you know, there have been moments in history before where we've had to side with people and with forces that we didn't find desirable to fight a common enemy. So
French, for example.
Well, in the Second World War, Roosevelt in the US and Churchill in the UK actually teamed up with Stalin to create the Great Alliance and to take on the Nazis. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of people leading up to that point would have never foreseen it, but it happened, and that was what was required. And so, yes, as you say, there is no absolute nice way of going about this. There are going to be difficult decisions that have to be made. And actually, one of the main points I make in my video is that the way we're going to get through this is not by overthrowing governments and creating power vacuums, because that is how Daesh thrived in Libya. It's how segments of it began in Iraq. Even if you believe you have a government that is going to replace it, you need to keep the structure in place for transition to occur, or else if you overthrow it and deconstruct it, it's just going to create even more of a mess. And that is something I am sincerely concerned about with Syria.
Well, thanks, Mark. That's super interesting. Because of time, we're going to have to smoothly transition now into the French regional elections, which actually does have a certain amount to do with the Paris bombings, which loosely is linked to IS. So that's a segue for you. The French are having an election this weekend and next weekend. And this is while the whole nation is still in a state of emergency after the Paris attacks carried out by Daesh, where 130 people were killed while they were in bars, concert halls, and just kind of generally having a lovely time, which was absolutely terrible. Obviously, I don't need to say that it was absolutely terrible.
I think we could take the terrible thing as read.
Yeah. Just as
you don't need to say you also disapprove of it. I think we can assume that.
Well,
the
rest of the internet feels like it has to have some kind of it's really terrible that these attacks have happened. So I'm just following suit. But what's very interesting with these elections is that we're seeing a surge in the National Front, the Front National, who are kind of, for a very long time, they're kind of like seen as the sister party of the British National Party in the UK. They, in the past, their founder, Jean-Marie Le Pen, he used to chat quite a lot about anti-Semitism. Their current leader, who is Jean-Marie Le Pen's daughter, Marine Le Pen, she thinks that the Holocaust was a minor detail in history.
No, that was her father.
No, that was that not Marine?
No. She was very embarrassed by that. She's made sort of big moves.
So Maureen is very embarrassed by that, but doesn't have a problem with the fact that Muslims shouldn't be in France. And then this whole family all have very similar names. Marion Le Pen, who is now...
It's Marion Maréchal Le Pen.
Maréchal Le Pen. She, Jesus Christ. This
Come
is,
on, Jazza, keep up with
that. This is the messiest introduction that we have ever done, by the way. And I'm so sorry to everybody involved. But she became France's youngest MP in the last elections. And now she's going for the seat in Alpes-Côte d'Azur. And it looks like the National Front are going to be winning at least a couple of the regional seats that are up for grabs in these elections, and looks like they're going to be placing first in the standings of things. Now, is this something that is very surprising at all, Jimmy? Because quite frankly, France is still reeling from the attacks by Islamist extremists. Of course they're going to be lurching to the right and kind of panicking and turning to the National Front, right?
I think actually, even had the Paris attacks not happened, there's still quite a lot of evidence that the National Front would have done quite well at these elections. Obviously, the things that have happened in the last couple of weeks play into their strengths concerning security, immigration, and that sort of thing. So, it's obviously, in that sense, the Paris attacks will be good for them electorally, as bad as that sounds to say. But I think that, as I said, Marine Le Pen has actually done an awful lot to actually try and sanitise their brand, much in the way that UKIP have made quite a lot of effort to distance themselves from the BNP in the UK. And actually, I think it's just part of a broader trend in Europe. There's a lot of dissatisfaction with political elites. There's a lot of concern about migration. And I just think, for some reason, in France, the National Front has always been somewhat stronger than the equivalent parties in the UK. And we're now finally seeing these kind of trends come to fruition through actual electoral wins.
Yeah. So do you think, how much of the rise of the National Front do you think is down to anti-Islam sentiment in France as a whole? And how much of it do you think is anti-European? Because I feel like UKIP in the UK, they have a particularly, they're quite good at distancing themselves from anti kind of religious or racial opinions. Oh, maybe that's a wrong perception that I have. And their argument is pretty much solely, completely, we should leave Europe because we can't control our borders. And that's kind of like the line that they take. Whereas the National Front seems to be much more mixed in terms of anti-Islam and anti-European. Which of those kind of like two prongs do you think is the strongest?
Well, with the UKIP thing, the reason they've had to make such an effort to actually distance themselves from the BNP is that even people in Britain who have concerns about immigration or who are even a bit racist often are very uncomfortable with the fascist thing, because
we're even a bit racist.
You think, like, if you're racist, like, fascism would kind of make more sense to you. But in Britain, because of the historical battle against Nazism and the importance of that to British national identity, it's been very hard for fascist parties, or explicitly fascist parties, to make any electoral gains or actually have influence, because the feeling against them for that reason is so strong. I think in France, that kind of thing is less significant. As I said, the National Front in France has always kind of been stronger, even in the days where they were saying awful things about the Holocaust.
And they had a sister party here, which was even pre-BNP, which was the British National Front. And that just ended up fizzling out because it just didn't have any legs.
I feel, Miles, do you actually have any views on sort of how the National Front kind of fit into the broader European picture?
What I was going to ask, actually, if I can just jump back a bit, was in terms of when we look at since the Paris attacks and what has changed with the policies that have been proposed. So we have the state of emergency. They've now passed a bill that means when a state of emergency happens, they can turn off social media sites and close down websites. I think they've extended the state of emergency for 3 months. They've banned protests in Paris, which obviously had implications with the climate march. I do wonder, are these things that would have still happened if there wasn't such a threat from these right-wing parties, which seem to be making ground? Because what we always find in politics is there's a real sense of having to seem to be the toughest on everything. So we can look at, even in our own country, it's who is toughest on terrorism, who is toughest on the economy.
Yeah, but man, I don't know, because after the Charlie Hebdo attacks, a nation led by a socialist president, François Hollande, put into place the most sweeping surveillance legislation that the Western world has ever seen. But it also ends up that didn't do anything, because there were still more attacks. And there was kind of like this perception that, oh, this is something that we need to do in order for us to protect like France and the French people. But it didn't bloody work. Yeah. And so there seems to be that kind of like a disconnect between what they think that we need to do and what actually has results.
That doesn't really contradict Miles's point, though, because the National Front was still strong in January. This isn't something that's happened over the past 8 months.
Yeah, you're right. But there has definitely been a surge in the past, since the attacks, though. There has been a bump in the polls, where they were originally kind of jostling for first place with Nicolas Sarkozy, the centre-right Les Républicains. But now it seems like the National Front is very much in head, ahead in the polls. Is this kind of like, does it say more about French politics than it does about kind of like the West's response to the rise of extremism?
I'm not sure that extremism is as important as all that. Obviously, the thing about the Paris attacks being important in this election is true, but I think the rise of the Front National is more to do with a general malaise about multiculturalism in France and a general lack of comfort with France becoming multiracial. France actually has also the largest Muslim population in Europe. I can't remember the actual figures, but it's former people coming over from North Africa, where the French used to have colonies. And I think the Front National is mostly a reaction to that, and also the feeling that the EU is actually just too powerful as well is quite important. The sense that the EU doesn't really act in French interests, it acts in broader interests, which sometimes run counter to France as well.
There was something interesting that Marine Le Pen said in terms of like the fascist overtones that the National Front has. And she said, having lived in the US and the UK, she can't understand how you can speak of the Tea Party in the US, who are mainstream political party, or a part of a mainstream political party. And then you can have UKIP in the UK, who say very similar stuff to the Front National. And then she gets chastised as like a fascist in France. How much of the chastising that the Front National gets, how much of that is justified, and how much of it is just kind of like the reaction to
It seems as though her argument is like, the Front National, we're only as crazy as the Tea Party in America. I'm not really sure that's a particularly strong argument. You know?
That's not a strong argument for us, but the Tea Party, at the end of the day, is taken very seriously in the US. And there's like mainstream political candidates who say that they're from the Tea Party, and they pretty much have their hands wrapped around the throat of the House of Representatives at the moment. So it, like, to say that is not... I understand where she's coming from.
I think UKIP is generally treated quite shoddily by the media, and it's that David Cameron comment of, was it fruitcakes and closet racists or something like that.
Yeah.
She's acting as though people respect UKIP in the UK, which is not true, really. I think the reason people worry more about the Front National is that in terms of like the French electoral system, it's far easier to do damage as a far-right party in continental Europe because they have more proportional representation, they have easier voting systems for smaller parties to actually you know, gain seats and actually gain power. Whereas,
and it is very possible for them to get quite far in the presidency as well. I can't remember who it was up against, but Jean-Marie Le Pen, who was the founder and former leader, actually got into the final round of voting. I think it was like 1999 or it was sometime in the 90s, because he came second in the national vote. But then just there's no way of them ever winning the presidency, because then every other rational French person then decides, oh, we're going to vote for whoever the National Front are. But it is interesting seeing them making these kind of gains in regional France, because I feel like in the UK, UKIP don't have the best reputation when it comes to governing locally, because the issues that they deal with are usually so macro. Whereas the National Front, they've recently won a few mayoralties, and they have a certain amount of power in the regions. And it will be interesting to see how they govern as kind of like a local party, beyond like the horror headlines that we've seen of, oh my god, French schools in this region, because it's run by the National Front, no longer have pork or no longer have halal food, for example.
I do wonder also the success they will have in France. Is that going to be only possible if voter turnout is less than normal, or will they actually get a surge in votes? Because we often find in a lot of areas of the world that more right-wing parties do tend to thrive when there's more
lower
apathy.
Turnout.
Yeah, and there's lower turnout. But I don't know if that's it. There's any truth to that.
I don't know about that. Yeah, but the polls seem to be taking into account voter turnout as well.
Right.
And to be completely honest, I'd be surprised if voter turnout is particularly low over these two weekends, just because of how on edge France is at the moment.
Very true.
Although the nation may once again let me down. Is there anything else that anybody would like to say about les Français et les élections régionales?
No, I think we're completely done here.
Très bon. On va maintenant continuer à parler de un YouTuber qui s'appelle Sam Pepper.
You're such a knob sometimes.
That's really good. I was just going to go, je jouais tennis de table.
Last week, Sam Pepper released a YouTube video in which he showed himself playing out a fake kidnapping of Colby, what's his surname?
I don't know. Why do you always ask questions that we clearly don't know the answer to?
Anyway, he'd arranged this prank with Sam of Sam and Colby, and Sam drove Colby out into this warehouse district in the middle of nowhere, and then Sam Pepper presumably creeped up on the other Sam and put a bag over his head. They locked him in the trunk of a car for 20 minutes, drove him to another location, and then pretended to shoot Colby in the head. Just to clarify on this point, I got the names a little bit mixed up. It is Colby who is in on the prank and is getting shot, and it's Sam who is getting pranked. What do you guys actually make of just the thinking behind this and the reason why they actually thought it was appropriate to put together this video?
That's a very good question. I mean,
why does Sam Pepper think it's appropriate to put together this kind of a video? Because he knows it gets him gets a fucking reaction. That's why. Sam is a particularly controversial character. I'll give a little bit of a background. The internet kind of blew up when he released the arse pinching prank, and he has a load of prank videos that essentially have him invading people's space, taking part in non-consensual activities with particular ladies.
I mean, groping would be a fair way of putting it, right?
He's just generally an asshole. And also he's had some allegations brought against him which haven't really come to anything of
sexual impropriety, shall we say.
Thank you very much for giving me those words to use, Jimmy. Meant a lot. And so the tone of this is not unprecedented. But it is an absolutely, it's a really difficult video to watch because of Sam's kind of like, he genuinely looks like he's having a breakdown. Like, he freaks out when he thinks his friend has been shot. But the, even though, like, at the end of it, they're, like, jovial and joking. But it is, it's just Sam Pepper being an asshole again. And I just worry that that's always going to happen.
This has really caught the attention of the mainstream media. I know most of the national papers ran a story on it. And there's been a lot of interest around it. Do you think this sort of thing actually shows the YouTube community in a really bad light and actually makes it seem like, you know, that they're a bit more out there than really they are?
I don't know.
What do you think, Jimmy?
Oh, you know. Mars, are you going to say something?
Yeah, I just feel that, you know, the world of YouTube and online video is so vast now that the lines are blurring with, you know, whether it's on Facebook video or YouTube. And Sam is just a product of this culture we've created where, you know, you have pranks like the cinnamon challenge and, you know, the snorting a condom prank and all this sort of stuff. And it's doing stuff to get views, to shock people. But once you've done that, you've then got to do one up on it. And it's not just a group of people trying to get one up on each other. This is a global competition. And it's what is the most extreme thing you can do that you can get away with that will generate viewership and generate a conversation. And I mean, I try and separate this with the controversy that happened before because I think there is a difference. But the whole issue of, I mean, I've watched the video and I found it quite boring and it's just not my sort of thing. And there's lots of questions of was it real or not, but they claim it is real. It wasn't staged in the sense that the guy that was freaking out, you know, wasn't in on it as well. Like, he was genuinely distressed from it, but they've spoken out afterwards and gone, well, yeah, that was, you know, this was filmed 2 weeks before we uploaded it. He's totally fine now. And that is just an amateur version of how these sort of things are normally done by, I hate to say professionals, but if we look at pranks that are done by Darren Brown, etc., when he does pranks and tricks on people which really shake up someone's perception of reality, they have to go through checks. They have to get psychologists involved to look and make sure that this person is safe for doing it, because this whole argument of, oh, but he was fine after. Yeah, after it happened. But you wouldn't have been saying those things if he had been absolutely distressed afterwards. And so I think, regardless of the video itself, I just think that there's just a real sense of the lack of responsibility I find quite shocking, especially when you think of his audiences and people who will now go away and think, oh, this is quite a fun idea. I might do that on my friends.
So that's the main issue I have with it. I have less of an issue with the video in itself, because it isn't him going up to strangers and groping them or making out with them.
So you're saying this is actually an improvement on his previous behaviour.
This is definitely an improvement in terms of the tone of his content. Like, he's made leaps and bounds. But I think that the main problem is, and we've seen this with kind of like other prank videos as well, taken out of context and taken into kind of like a space where people are going to be mimicking that, that's going to just create an absolutely foul culture where there's a load of bullshy teenage kids. Teenage boys are idiots. I know because I was one, and I would have probably tried to copy this at some point in my teenage existence.
You say that, but when the likes and the dislikes were actually open on this YouTube video, it was overwhelmingly people disliking it.
Yeah, because Sam Pepper is a particularly distasteful character and they want to be outraged by him. People love being outraged. And I think that it's less to do with the actual content. I don't like it's difficult to watch and it isn't a great thing, but he's doing it to somebody who at the end of the day is fine and has kind of in a roundabout way consented to doing it and thinks it's hilarious that the internet has kind of blown up about it. And I think that it's more the influence that is going to get, because then it's going to kind of show, because everybody has a editing software in their phone now. Everybody can replicate these kinds of videos. And it's just, that's what I particularly worry about. It's less about the video itself. It's more about the fallout of it. And now people think that extreme pranks are going to be okay. And the amount of times that actually these pranksters, in quotation marks, have had a team come in and assess like a situation, or have actors taking the place of what look like they're real people, that's all really, really blurred. And people just assume that you can go up to women on the street and make out with them and it's fine. That's hilarious. And if she calls you a misogynist twat, she's a feminazi and doesn't deserve your time and deserves to be shouted at and abused. And I worry about this little corner of the internet and the amount of influence that it gets, because people...
I think you're maybe overreacting about, I mean, comparing this to...
I don't think so.
Comparing this to, like, the pickup community or whatever, that's obviously a pretty different thing.
Yeah, I'm talking about the genre as a whole, I think, rather than just... I don't think people are going to start pretending to kill each other.
So you don't actually think there'll be copycat videos then?
I think that it sets a precedent for the how extreme it has to be. And it's only, maybe it isn't only a matter of time, but I feel like there's going to be people that perhaps copy this and can leave somebody emotionally scarred for a while, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's how easy it is to do it yourself, and it only requires one person to do it. But then... I guess with anything we ever put online, there is always a chance of someone taking something and it going wrong. But obviously, the more extreme your video is and the actions you take, the higher propensity there is of someone else doing it and it going wrong. And so I just go back to my first point about this is just taking the bar up even further of what extreme pranks have to happen to really do it. Like, this is going to become normality, and it's like, how do you outdo this again?
I will say, though, I think that some of the outrage that we've seen has kind of been because people wanted to be outraged by it. Like, there are particular people, Carrie Hope Fletcher, who's also a YouTuber, tweeted about the fact that, implied that the whole style of the kidnapping was reminiscent of, like, an ISIS execution video. And I feel like that was a bit of a stretch. I feel like people were looking for things that they wanted to be outraged by and then express to the world that they were outraged by it. And so in that sense, it kind of showed a bit of an ugliness to that side of the internet as well.
So you don't actually think, looking at this video, bearing in mind all the events that have happened over, particularly in the last month, but also over the past couple of years, that was a reasonable inference to draw?
I don't think that it was an influence of an ISIS video. I think it was an influence of a standard gangster kind of trope of somebody being chucked in the back of a car and then, like, tied up on a chair. I think that that's what they were going for. When I watched it, I didn't think, this is the mimicking of an ISIS execution. Although I can understand why people would assume that it was.
Yeah, I mean... There is definitely a lot of confirmation bias that comes to play with this, where there's going to be a lot of people out there who don't like Sam Pepper and want to take him out at any opportunity possible, and they will do that. And so it's kind of like the arguments they may make against the video may be legitimate, but it's also looking at the intention, because, for example, if this was done by someone else, would there be as much of an outrage? And actually, this could be quite justifiably so. The reason there is this outrage at Sam Pepper in particular is because he has done these outrageous things in the past and he hasn't really suffered any consequences as a result. And actually, where, as someone who used to know Sam Pepper myself, the thing I have found...
And full disclosure, I did as well.
Yeah. The thing I find most frustrating about the path that Sam Pepper has been on is I don't get a sense of any learning with his previous mistakes. Now, he may have done and he just doesn't publicize them, but I think that could be a really important thing. There's always this sense of him doubling down, and it even happened with the previous pranks he did where he was groping people. I think he made a third video saying, oh, this was all to get awareness out of this sort of stuff.
Yeah, he had another video of a girl going around and pinching guys' asses, but frankly I call bullshit on that.
Yeah, and so for me, the frustration is, I just hope that, I don't know, you just want to get a sense of responsibility. And I could be wrong, but I'd like to think I'm quite rational with a judgment on this sort of thing, and I don't get the sense that he is really being responsible with it. And he has done a few interviews since that video, which I checked out just before doing this podcast, and it's this whole sense of, oh, it was just a laugh, and you know, it's on their heads if they take it the wrong way. And it's like, well, whether or not people are correct in judging it as a bad video, the point that people do feel that way is something you should take into consideration, because there are going to be lots of people that may start copycatting it who you may argue, well, it was never meant to be copycatted, that's their problem. Well, no, that's a reality, and that's something you should take responsibility for as someone of your stature in the online world.
Just as a last question, do you think YouTube have any responsibility to kind of better regulate these sorts of videos if you have those concerns about copycats?
Oh, like they should take the videos down if they like violate their terms of use, right? So that includes, so that's eventually why the finger pinching, like the ass pinching prank, was taken down, because it showed sexual assault. Whereas this, the reason that it hasn't been taken down, and also, like, briefly, we don't have time to talk into this in depth, but an anonymous Twitter account said that they were going to start wreaking havoc on his website and on the video and take down the video. It then transpired that a larger anonymous cell said that they didn't back this up because it would take away freedom of speech, and that it was YouTube's job to take stuff down that violated like terms of use. So that was a very interesting side story that I was following over the week. But I think that they should take it down when it breaks laws, but I don't think that this particularly breaks any laws. Miles, it's just a horrible video.
Miles, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of like the terms and conditions, I assume that one of them, don't know if this exact terminology is in it, but the incitement of violence. And if so, there's a conversation to be had of, does that video incite violence? It doesn't tell other people to go out and do it, but if other people start copying it, I mean, just look at the demographics of the video, of what age people are watching it. Is that something that should be watched, you know, with people under the age of 18? I don't know. I just don't know. I think there's just so much risk in it. Sam, whether you like him or not, is very talented in many different ways. I just feel that he should use those talents for more useful.
That's very generous of you.
Well, he is, because there's a reason why he's been succeeding with a big audience, and it hasn't always been because he's done outrageous stuff. He's done other stuff which is clever, and when I am generous with that, that's not to say I agree with him or even like the stuff he does, but he's clearly done stuff well that is good for marketing, and I wish he'd use it for better uses, not just when he's trying to cover his back after doing something disgusting.
With great power comes great responsibility.
Yeah.
All right. And on that final heartwarming thought, we need to wrap up.
We do. Miles, where can people find you on the internet? Where can they find you on Twitter?
So twitter.com/MilesDyer. So that's MilesDyer. And youtube.com/Miles.
Cool. I'm at JazzaJohn on Twitter if you want to wade into the chat with me. Jimmy, what are you on?
I'm at JDE Nichols, and you can find the Right Dishonourable podcast at Right Dishonour or at www.rightdishonourable.com.
Definitely only two W's in that www.
Oh, well, whatever. you'll work it out. It'll be fine.
Goodbye, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.